people dead in the streets. And Mr. President, he bout that cash. He got a policy for handling the niggas in trash. And if you poor, you black. I laugh, they won't give you ass. You better off on crack. Dead or in jail or with a gun in Iraq. And it's as simple as that. No opinion, my man, it's mathematical fact. Listen, a million poor since 2004. And they got aliens and killians to waste on a war. And make it question what the taxes is for. Or the cost to reinforce the broke levy war. Tell the boss he shouldn't be the boss anymore. Yahweh, I mean, God save these streets. $1 per area.
Hey everybody, welcome to Voices from the Frontlines. I'm your host, Eric Mann. This is KPFK 90.7 FM, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. This is the Voices from the Frontlines public affairs show. I'm in studio with Patrice Cullors and Damon Osley, with whom I was buddies, partners, roommates, everything else for 2 weeks in New Orleans. And I think as much as we thought about it, as much as we read about it, it's one of those things where it's sort of beyond what the mind can understand if the eyes can't see. Patrice, what would you say is the most shocking thing you saw and the most hopeful thing you saw?
That's a really good question. thank you, Eric, for having me on the show. I think the most shocking thing I saw, amongst many, many shocking things in New Orleans, was going down the streets of Central City and knowing that just a year before Katrina hit, those were cities that had black children in schools, black parents and black youth in the projects, and seeing that it was a ghost town. And we went down these streets and nobody was there, seeing that the projects were barbed wired up like jail cells, seeing that the schools were barbed wired, and knowing that the New Orleans government was really trying to keep black people out of the city. I think that is the most shocking. You know, many people are like, well, can't they just come back? And, you know, it seems like it would be easy, but it was very obvious in that moment, sitting on that street with the barbed wire, that the government was not allowing and not wanting the black people to come back to New Orleans. And I think the most hopeful thing I saw was Safe Streets Strong Communities put on their first meeting of residents in New Orleans, and about 45 majority black people sat in a room talking about their experiences after Katrina, talking about their experiences before Katrina with the police, and talking about how they're going to fight the police back, how they're going to fight for their lives, sharing their really personal and emotional experiences and abuses that they face with the police, and feeling by the end of that actual meeting that they were excited about the next steps that they were going to take their lives back.
One of the parents there had an experience that was similar to something happened in your life. Is it okay to talk about it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There was a moment in that meeting. The entire meeting was based on a couple things, and one of them was this woman was sharing her story. She actually did a skit about how the police had beat her son, and her son was going through a manic episode. He was mentally ill, and the police had beat her son, put him in handcuffs, and after they had put him in handcuffs, tasered him. And in that moment, I was floored, because that is the same exact experience that I had here in LA about 11 months ago. My brother has schizoaffective disorder, been in and out of prison, never really diagnosed because he's a black man. And he was running from the police because he was in the middle of a manic episode. They had shot him with pellet guns, tasered him, and handcuffed him. And it was I think for me, it was one of those moments where a magnifying glass was basically put over this racist institution that from Los Angeles to New Orleans, this same exact experience could happen to a family, the same exact tactics in torturing black people.
Damon Azali, when we got involved in the community rights campaign and called for 1,000 more buses, 1,000 less police, a lot of people in L.A. said, well, you know, most people in the black community want more police. They want more safety. What was your sense in talking to people in New Orleans about it? And doesn't mean that nobody was interested in safety, but what was the complexity of the conversations you had with people about the police in New Orleans and some analogies with L.A.?
Well, I think that's interesting, particularly in reference to your commentary. So when you were talking about after the World Conference Against Racism was talking about the transatlantic slave trade. And so when I was thinking at that point, who were the people who actually benefited at that point? And it was the slave traders and it was the plantation owners. And I think there is a thread that goes through. And if we look at Iraq, if we look at what's happening in the Gulf Coast after Katrina, it's the same kind of thread. You just change the name. So instead of slave traders, you have police and military. And instead of the plantation owners, you have the corporations that are behind. I kind of like the wheels are greased by the Bush administration, but really it goes very much deeper than that. So the Halliburtons, et cetera, et cetera. So I think when we look at that thread, that's the main thing that a lot of the politicians are even talking about. The city of New Orleans actually has half the amount of people that it had pre the levees breaking, but they're still trying to get more cops. It's not 1,000 like here, but I think it's like something like 700 cops that they're trying to get. And the thing, so if you have half the people, but you still want to increase cops, it just, I mean, when you were saying what is the shocking thing, that's one of the shocking things that I hear coming from that side. And I think what I've heard coming from the other side of people at, you know, the different rallies that I was out, meetings that I was talking to, the membership meeting that Patrice was speaking of, you actually have working class black people who are saying police are not going to make us safer, particularly when they beat up my son every week. We had a couple of people who were saying how actually, one woman who had three sons that basically were beat up by police every week, and she was scared to actually report it because she was saying, "I don't. It might make it worse." And a lot of the organizers were saying, "If it got worse, they might be dead." So we need to actually move to that. So I think that that is a very uncomplicated, unnuanced way to think about policing. And I think the real actual black community thinks about it way more complexly because they're also at the end of either the end of a baton or a flashlight or under the threat of being under the end of a baton or a flashlight.
This is Eric Mann on Voices from the Frontlines. You're talking with Damon Azali and Patrice Cowers, who just came back from New Orleans. Again, let's go back to the hope. Tell us a little about the march on the 29th, the first anniversary. What was it like for you, Damon? What'd you see? What'd you do? Then we'll get to you as well, Patrice.
So
tell us about suitcase dragging.
Suitcase dragging. So I think the march that was put on by People's Hurricane Relief Fund on the 29th was a lot of things kind of coming together. I think there was a really, really a try to kind of get more of kind of the ancestor kind of ancestor recognition that was starting off. So in the beginning, it was calling out the names of the people who have died because of the levees breaking. Then talking about what are the kind of politics actually trying to push forward. So, you know, trying to combine a lot of times which are separate. I think going back to where, you know, well, what's happening in the churches when churches or mosque, or now when, you know, Malcolm and Martin were talking, it's trying to get people to be motivated and touched on the spiritual level, but then through the politics. So I think in terms of that, there were a bunch of people. We started in the Industrial Canal in the 9th Ward where the levee broke, and you can see it was pretty, I mean, I wish I would have saw pictures before, because it was basically this field of a lot of grass. And I'm assuming that there, like the way the other levees were, there were a lot of houses there before. There were very few houses. Some of them were just kind of like a big giant took it and just kind of pried it open and pried it apart to see kind of what was inside, you know. It was about a 5 mile march. It was 95 degrees? 95 degrees. We were selling Katrina Legacies, and I was very happy to roll them in a suitcase for half the march, and then we got a car to do it the rest of the way. And I think one other thing that was really interesting, and particularly when we talk about Katrina's legacy, which I'm sure a lot of people have heard about, it was amazing to be where the rally point was at the end of the march, where, you know, normally when you're going to sell books, you're like, hey, you got to read this book, and because it's, you know, it's talking about this. It situates, you know, 400 years of U.S. history in 70 pages, and it talks about the second Reconstruction and da-da-da. And you're halfway talking about it, and they're like, yeah, how much is it? It's like you don't even have to do that. And I think that that was a real, real important thing that, you know, I think pushes back against a lot of what folks have in terms of an image or a concept of working and poor black people, that they don't really want to engage in politics. And I think a lot of it is because we either try to dumb it down or try to assume what folks are interested in. A lot of times that's what you get. You get people who are disinterested because they're not being challenged. And so I think a lot of stuff when we talk about our work through the electoral arena or in terms of City Hall, it's really trying to really have a nuanced conversation and talk about tactic, talk about strategy, and believing that that's really going to not only touch people politically, but also touch their soul morally, and they go, okay, I can get down with this.
On second, we're at KPFK, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and worldwide on the web on www.kpfk.org. And the host is me, Eric Mann. The guests are Damon Azali and Patrice Cullors. The subject is what happened in New Orleans and what's going to happen in New Orleans. And right around 4:45, we'll be taking your phone calls. And the number to call is 818-985-5735. That is 818-985-5735. For those of you who almost understand the reference, I have written a book called Katrina's Legacy, White Racism and Black Reconstruction, New Orleans at the Gulf Coast. It's www.frontlinespress.com if you're interested. And among the many things we did down to New Orleans was to bring a book, to sell a book at a reduced price, but to get it in the hands of people. And it was pretty beautiful as an author to thank both of you as well as Francisca Porches and Mark Anthony Johnson, how we would just sort of be standing outside of events and holding up the book. And as you said, I mean, before you'd even say something, people would say, I'll take two, you know, and all they needed to see was white racism and black reconstruction and that beautiful picture of a group of black people on a raft look like they're being led into the promised land or at least out of the inferno. And it was a very exciting part of it. Let's talk a little bit about the black nation. Leaving aside what the theory of the black nation, leaving aside that this is a controversial subject and that we don't have a fully developed view on, is the black nation in the South or is also throughout the United States? Is the black nation have the right to self-determination, including up to and including the right of secession? There's a lot of debates that need to be continued, but we did, as you're wearing, Damon, bring a shirt down there that said self-determination for the black nation. Speaking for yourselves, start with Patrice and then go to Damon, what do you think the black nation is, and what do you think it meant to you going down to New Orleans? And the second question is, what did folks down there think when you're wearing a t-shirt like that? What was the response to it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, one, I think for me, being a black person born in Los Angeles, it was a gift to go down to the South, particularly New Orleans. And one of the gifts, I think, is actually growing up in Los Angeles. It's just a different demographic here, heavily Latino. And growing up as a black person, I did not see many black workers. As Los Angeles became deindustrialized, as GM Van Nuys was shut down, which my father was a mechanic there for over 10 years, and was forced into, you know, little mechanic shops and has not had a stable job ever since. It was really amazing to go to the South and actually see black people using their hands and working. Like, I just kept on talking to Francisca, and I was like, there's black people working. Like, that is a big thing. You know, that's a really big thing. And the unemployment rates for black people is so high in Los Angeles. So going down to New Orleans, going down to the South was a gift. And I think for me, I have such a strong connection to the South. My family is all in Louisiana, Eunice and Lake Charles, and they've been there for a really long time. And I do see whatever my understanding of a black nation is in this moment of understanding a black nation, it being very clear that that will happen in the South. I do see so much that can happen from the black people down there. And it's the reason why for me New Orleans is so important in fighting this fight for black people is because I really feel like if we lose this fight, I'm really scared for black people across the entire U.S. And wearing this T-shirt, I'll tell you where we first wore it. We were, it was myself, Mark Anthony, Damon Azali, and Francisca Porchas, and we went to go to breakfast one morning. Oh, wow. And we, you know, we're in the South. We're from L.A., not realizing that the South is still very segregated. And so we go into this little coffee shop, and we have our self-determination shirts on.
All four of us.
And we're looking around. We're like, maybe this wasn't the place to have this shirt. So we sit down. We eat our breakfast. We look behind us, and there's all these pictures, and there's pictures of these white people in blackface, and they have Confederate flags, pictures of Confederate flags, and it was a powerful moment. I mean, it was one of those moments where you're like, I am clear about why I am fighting. I'm clear about why I'm fighting for black folks when in 2006, you can still, as a black person, sit in a restaurant and see a white person in blackface and see a Confederate flag up as if it is no big deal. I think for me that was just really clear on, one, why black people have been so at the forefront of fighting against racism, but two, why it's so important that we figure out how we take power back, how we have our own power. So,
I mean, just this in terms of the reference of how do we feel with the shirts and, you know, who, what did other people think when they came to it? So we have, you know, on one end, which, you know, I think both ends are the mavericks. If you were doing statistical analysis, you would cut them off. So then there was one person who bought 20 shirts. And also on the back it says, right to return, reparations now. So somebody bought 20 shirts, and then the other end there are people who kind of walked up and, like, we're like, because, you know, it has the red, black, and green flag, and, you know, it's real. Folks, we're going to get more. So we haven't plugged it yet, but on the 28th of September, Emmanuel Presbyterian Church at 6:30, all of us are going to do a report back, and we ordered a bunch more shirts. So it's basically like five or six black folks drawn by Sanyaka Bryant, who's the people's artist, pulling up a red, black, and green flag, and then there's probably maybe, you know, a 10-year-old girl with afro puffs that has her, like, left fist in the air. I mean, so that with the flag, and then also, oh, forgot, it has the most important part. It has basically the Black Belt South separated from the U.S. with, you know, colored red, black, and green, you know, new states and whatnot. So, you know, people come up and they're like, oh, that's a great shirt. They're looking at it from distance, and they look and it says, self-determination for the black nation. And so then sometimes people just kind of get quiet and go, oh. They don't even, the sound doesn't even come out of their mouth, and they go, okay. And I was like, oh, yeah, they're only $10. What do you think? And then they kind of walk on. But I think in general, way I was talking about, I was saying, you know, it's a visual aid, you know, for Katrina's legacy. Because I think it's one, I think, was designed to say that, you know, one, we support black self-determination in the forms that, you know, we hope that it takes, that it used to take, that we hope that it gets back there too. But I think it's also in the kind of view of the United Front, looking at the right and the progressive, which I don't even call progressive anymore, is really trying to put another another discussion piece within that spectrum of broad analysis. And I think a lot of people were like, a couple of people said, you know, I haven't seen something like that for 25, 30 years. And I think that's the point. It's like, for us as a black liberation movement, for us as a movement that is in solidarity with the black liberation movement, it's like we have to have these things on the table. Because if we don't, if we're splitting the difference between, you know, middle of the road and right wing, you know, that's where we are now. So we need to push it a lot more and push our politicians a lot more to the left.
Well, it's interesting. I'm here. This is Eric Mann, your host for today. I'm here with Damon Azzalee, Patrice Cowers. We're all from the Labor Community Strategy Center. We all came back from New Orleans. I had an experience where a woman was buying a book, and she looked at the T-shirt, and she said, yeah, I'm in the Black Nation, huh? You know, just sort of like it was more like a common thing. Let's talk about the right of return, the effective right of return. I mean, I'll start with a couple of thoughts I had, and then throw it back to both of you. I mean, one thing I learned a lot with this interviewer is that the of how many black people were sort of independent workers in the South before Katrina, that they were roof builders, they were sort of small businessmen, half-slash workers, and they had their own trucks to pick up things, they had a roofing business. They didn't have a lot of money, there was mainly their own labor. And because of Katrina, they were just driven out of the economy, and the government hasn't done anything to help them, and it would take almost no money to get them a truck and some roofing equipment, a ladder and a few things to get them started again. Second, I was really surprised that I didn't get fully what it meant to be a renter. Because if you're a renter and you're unemployed, it means you don't exist in the U.S. economy. So if you're in Houston, if you're in Atlanta right now, if you're dispersed and you say, I want to come home, if there's not a political movement to bring you home, what, quote, rights do you have in a country that's based on property rights, not on national rights? So if we don't talk about people's rights as nationally oppressed people to make demands against the United States, if we don't have movement leaders saying, come on back, I don't care if you got a job, I don't care if you got an apartment, come on back, we'll have squatters movements, but you as a black person have the right to come back. If you're broken up as an individual and said, come on back if you have an insurance policy, come on back if you got a job, come on back if you have a lease. Well, if you didn't have any of those things before you left, how are you going to get them back? So I was really struck by the need for a national movement, national meaning a black movement, a black-led movement of nationally oppressed people, to create the cohesiveness that the market economy isn't giving folks. Why don't we end as we're going to go to the phones with any thoughts you had about what we call the Black United Front, different forces there, things you thought about what it would take to bring folks back, and any contradictions you saw, and any contradictions you saw within the Black United Front that would have to be resolved better if we're going to have a more successful movement.
Well, this is the thing that I've been trying to think about the most, because I think in the middle of the last radio show that I was being interviewed on, which was last week, actually 2 weeks ago, was the similarities between what was going on in New Orleans and what's going on in Los Angeles in terms of, in particular, the kind of black middle bourgeoisie. So I went also back to look at, you know, one of the, you know, famous left scholars, Mao from China. And I just, I would encourage people just to people who are doing organizing work to actually read it, because it talks, the particular piece I'm talking about is analysis of classes in Chinese society. And it talks about from the top down in terms of money, who to actually ally with in the United Front, who to try to neutralize in the United Front. And I think the one thing that was just really interesting to me in this particular time where not only the black bourgeoisie but also Latino bourgeoisie are being elected into government positions, et cetera, is really trying to figure out how much of the integration push from the civil rights movement actually happened. And I think it happened to a certain degree, but I think it only happened with a certain sector of people of kind of, I would say, still say pseudo-integration. And I think a lot of that, what I saw in terms of the political officials in New Orleans, were that they were in the positions they were if they won, didn't identify with the oppressed nationality working class. So if it was loosely talking about black, but really talking about poor people, that kind of got you into the club. I think if any kind of identification and demands with the working class, the renters, that what Eric was talking about, that pushed them out. I think you can talk in national specific demands like the right of return, but there was very little that I saw, particularly from those folks, who were actually making it a realistic thing. It was like, we're going to return, we're going to come back, we're going to do it, you know? But then it was like, okay, how do you do it? So I think that that's another piece. So some of that is even the agitational stuff without any kind of tactical moves underneath, which it inherently is empty. And then I think the sad part about it, I think, is a lot of it is just subjugating the interests of your people for the interests of the people who are in power. And you're kind of like the middle person between that stuff. So I felt like a lot of times in terms of the main goal of gentrification, really, of New Orleans, of the central city, that starting with the Ninth Ward, a lot of that was the same people in the city council who were oppressed nationality were making room for the developers come in and steal people's property and take it up. And all that to say is I believe very much in a united front theory, meaning that we have to unite everybody we can unite to fight for the rights of the most oppressed, the working class and whatnot. But I think within the black bourgeoisie, there's definitely, when there's actually a movement to really pressure them, there's going to have to be splits. So I'm not saying give up or whatnot, but I'm saying, like, we need to understand that all the demands that we fight for really, really have to, one, have a race analysis at the root of it, and then secondly, it has to be the working class and the poor of the blacks, of the Latinos, of the Koreans, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Let me hold you there. We're almost ready to go to the phones, which is 818. In fact, we are ready to go to the phones at 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-5735. As we wait for your calls, a couple of things. As we told you, that you're with Damon Azzali and Patrice Cullors. My name is Eric Mann. Normally, Damon and I co-host the show. Today, he's been the guest, one of the guests. We hope you'll join us on Thursday, the 28th of September, at the Emmanuel Presbyterian Church, where myself, the three of us, along with Francisca Porchas and Mark Anthony Johnson, will be able to go into a lot more detail, both about our experiences in New Orleans, what we observed, and what we can do to help, because we're meeting in the next couple of days with Kali Akunu, who's just been appointed the Executive Director of the People's Hurricane Relief Fund. And as you can imagine, 1 year after Katrina, that's probably as far as most people's attention spans can go. Mm-hmm. And yet it's going to be 10 and 15 and 20 years after Katrina that we're still going to have to fight for the right of return, mm-hmm, to bring 250,000 black people back to New Orleans. So please attend. The book we were talking about is Katrina's Legacy, White Racism and Black Reconstruction, New Orleans and the Gulf Coast. For all this stuff, and all the other groups we mentioned today, the important Alex Caputo Pearl demonstration, the attorney Lynn Stewart, who's in danger of 30 years in prison, call us right now at 213-387-2800 or right after the show, 213-387-2800, to hear information specifics on the five different ways of getting involved that I mentioned, the meeting on the 28th. So now we'll do that one more time at the end. But now, do we got any calls? Can I get a witness here? Mm. On his cell, he's first. Hey, how are we doing, Maggie? Can we get somebody in here? Guy, are you? Let's talk to Guy.
Hi, Eric.
What did you think of the show? And tell us something controversial, interesting, and fascinating real fast.
Okay. A little while ago, you asked the question, what are you going to do about it?
That's right.
Okay, and then the two examples you gave to what you can give, I forget what they were, but as a Marxist daily illness, I have to say that it is nothing but more reformism. And reformism has proved impotent, has proved futile. And unless you guys can come right out and say that we have to eliminate capitalism, we're never going to solve any of this, because it's all about reformism. You have an old friend of mine, an old Marxist friend of mine, who's now dead, but got about 100 years old, said that he listened to KPFK shortly before he died. He said, you know, they almost say it, but they never do. And you have to say it.
Okay.
I'm a Marxist.
Guy, we'll get to you. We'll get it to
you. Declare it.
I'll take that one. Is that okay?
Mm-hmm.
To say I'm a Marxist, I'm a Marxist. To say I'm a revolutionary, I just said I'm a revolutionary. But to misunderstand and not care about, I'm telling you that a woman named Lynn Stewart, who is defending an Arab who has been convicted, is going to go to jail if we don't stop it for 30 years. If we don't stop that, if we don't protect, if you think that's a reform because she's going to go to jail for 30 years and die in prison, if you think that a teacher who stands up against the racism of the system and is going to be transferred out of a black school, if you think that giving money to the People's Hurricane Relief Fund and trying to both help people clean out their buildings, build a movement for the right of return, if that bores you, that is, in fact, the very structure of what good Marxism looks like. If you don't care about the people and their daily struggle, that is the revolution reflected every day. And if you turn your back on that and think that unless you say the word capitalism, imperialism, and Marxism every 2 minutes, you're going to have a very, very lonely, isolated, sad, rejected Marxism. So next question, we're going to get Ben in Long Beach. Damon, without knowing what it is, you got the next one.
Yeah, basically the question, you mentioned that the book that you wrote, White Racism, are you suggesting that that racism is only a system of that is controlled by people that classify themselves as white, or you say there's some other form of racism by any other racial classification?
I mean, that sounded like that was Eric. I can answer it.
Yes, I think it was Eric Mann.
Well, I mean, I think the main thing that we talk about racism, it's like people can have prejudice and not, like, black people can not like Korean people can not like Latino people, etc. But if you look historically on the structural racism, institutional racism that will give Lynn Stewart, you know, 30 years in prison because she's defending the rights of an oppressed nationality person, that's the kind of racism that we talk about. The other stuff around prejudice is like,
okay, let me give you a point of the type of racism that I've been studying, and looking at and examining and analyzing. I believe, based on the United Compensatory Code system, a textbook for victims of racism, white supremacy. I believe that there's only one form of racism on the planet between the people of the known universe, and that is a system called white racism. There's no other racism that affects people collectively and directly other than that system. And that is the system we need to deal with if we're going to change anything, whether it's capitalism, whether it's anything. Until we deal with the science and the system and the ideology of white racism on this planet, nothing's going to change for anyone by any other racial classification.
Well, let me respond to you, brother. I agree with you.
Ideology of white racism.
Excuse
on this planet.
I agree with you. Let me respond to you. The name of the book is called Katrina's Legacy, White Racism, which is what you said, and Black Reconstruction in New Orleans and the Gulf Coast. My theory of the book, which is not the main point of today's show, is that a white European Christian racism that's based on colonialism, that's based on a belief that other non-Christians will go to hell, that is believed on a sexually repressed theory of sin that's based on the subjugation of women, but that at its core is an imperialism, and that it's rooted in the ideology of many things, but especially the ideology of white racism, which leads to cruelty, which leads to why 250,000 black people are not like in, which leads to why there's 1.1 million black people in prison, a punitiveness, a hatred. That's a lot of what my book goes into, and I think we agree. So with that, I'll take the next caller, which is looks like Juan in Hollywood. Is that right, Juan? Do we got you? Hola, Juan. Who are we getting here? Bornu in L.A.?
I think Juan is on.
Juan in North Hollywood.
Okay, Juan.
Hi. I just want to make a comment because I am Latin American, and I think we shouldn't romanticize, you know, that Latins are only prejudiced towards blacks and stuff like that, or towards Indians, because that's very deep rooted in ourselves also. It is, it manifests itself in the language that we use sometimes to say negritos, for example, little black people. So I think racism has to be taken, you know, by the horn, and, you know, avoid doing this thing that Latinos are only prejudiced, because that's not true. Latinos could be very racist against indigenous people, against black people, and against people from Asia. The chinitos. I mean, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I just want to make that comment.
Well, thank you. Patrice can maybe respond to that. Patrice Carr, thank you for calling so much.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the biggest things that we talk about, particularly within the Bus Riders Union, we really try to work on all of what divides us as people of color, as black, Latino, Korean people in particular that we work with. And the types of things that we talk about, we have conversations around, you know, Katrina's legacy and black people, the Middle Passage. We have Black History Nights where everybody in the organization comes together and we reconstruct our own internal prejudices and what white racism has done to black and Latino people and how we've been pitted against each other. So definitely agree that we all hold some serious contradictions, and we really try to work on that within the Bus Riders Union, within the Strategy Center.
Okay, who's our next call? We look like Bornu in L.A., is that correct? Can we get Bornu on?
Yeah, this is me.
How you doing?
All right, yourself?
Good, glad to have you.
I have a solution to so-called racism.
Okay, great. We've been waiting for one.
It'll take a while, maybe 1,000 years.
Right.
But we have to get away from this color scheme put on humanity, using the innocence of color to divide and conquer people. I know a lot of people don't want to give up their so-called identities or tags or labels, but if we adopt that we're all African, original people, beautiful people, and move in that sense, then we'll eliminate all of the race and racism, which in this term, in a sense, means that we're all racing as these different ethnic groups towards some kind of whatever it is. It actually is madness. Also, I want to say, is that these, our so-called Latino brothers and sisters, are letting the so-called Latino mayor get away with murder. He's deceived us. He's gotten there in an office, and he's turned into one of them, quote unquote. And, I don't hear, I was talking to a so-called Latino brother the other day. He said he's going to support the mayor just because he's so-called Latino. And I said so-called Latino because I want to get away from those labels too. And this is unacceptable. He wants to turn LA along with the chief into even more of a police state. He supported Israel when our Jewish, so-called Jewish brothers and sisters had that rally over there. We need to challenge this guy because he is not, working in our best interest. So
we totally agree with you, Damon. Tell him about the 28th of I hope you're going to join us in on the 17th of October.
Yeah, because actually that's one of the things that we've been working on for the last over a year, is actually trying to figure out how to put some left pressure on the mayor. Because we know where he comes from, and we think that part of the reason why the decisions in terms of more police, more rail, all these things that don't really benefit what I said before, the kind of working class black Latino strata, that's because there's not a lot of pressure coming from the left. And so you're calling for it, we're going for it. So all October 17th, we're going to be on City Hall steps and having a rally and to basically say, you know, Mr. Mayor, we respectfully disagree. So that's
what
one.
That
hey, Eric.
Yeah.
One more thing.
Sure.
Okay. You know, these marches, come on now. The so-called oppressors, that's all they want people to do. Oh, yeah, you can march. March all day long. We don't give a damn. Even speak. Say whatever you want. We don't give a damn. That stuff is nothing.
Well, wait. Let me respond to you here. You'll be surprised if it's nothing how many community groups are frightened of doing it. You'll be surprised if it's nothing why the mayor, through the use of contracts, threats, telling people that if you march on City Hall on the 17th of October that you'll never get a this or you'll never get a that. The number of groups, frankly, who have one little issue, and if that issue, maybe the mayor is good on that issue. He's not good on keeping black kids out of prison. He's not good at keeping Latinos out of prison. He's not good at getting us to our schools. He's trying to take over the school. The mayor's got a lot of things that are not just going to solve through pressure. The mayor is casting himself, as he said in the recent Latino Forum, Congreso, that he sounded a lot like he said, as I was with Bill Clinton and Tony Blair the other day, dropping those names, well, if you've been hanging around with Bill Clinton and Tony Blair, what do they have in common? It's a so-called triangulation strategy. What that means is you get elected by progressives, but then once you're in office, you ally with the right and you ally with the center and you isolate the left. So maybe you think there's more revolutionary things involved besides marching on City Hall on Tuesday, October 17th. But let me tell you, brother, you'll be surprised at how many people will not do it and how many people we need to do it. So for all these good causes, including groups that we're trying to get attention to, please call us at 213-387-2800 at the Strategy Center to find out about the 28th of September when Patrice Collis is in studio and Damon Azzali, myself, and others will talk about our New Orleans trip. To find out how you can help Lynn Stewart, the attorney under attack. To find out how you can get money to the People's Hurricane Relief Fund. To talk about how you can help Alex Caputo Pearl, who's a teacher fighting for his job to be able to teach in Crenshaw High School. For all those things, call this one shop number and let's get involved. How many minutes we got? We got a couple left? Great.
Now, okay. Just one more thing on that. To respond is like, in terms of the marching, if you just march and that's all you do, or if you just do a petition and that's all you do, yeah, it's right, nothing's going to happen. But when we're out on the buses 5-6 days a week, marching, building a base is the key thing. So I think that's another thing. If people are interested in doing organizing, whether it's on the buses or door-to-door, you should also call that number because we're definitely looking for good anti-racist, particularly bilingual, black and Latino folks to come out and do it.
Al from Inglewood, let's do it. Or we have Dago from Hacienda Heights, is that correct?
Yes, really quickly. Look, this issue boils down to economics. If we are not going to empower ourselves to be an economic driving force, we are not going to change things. So I believe in Brother Malcolm's position. We got to be self-reliant. We gotta develop the strength in our economic power. If not, nothing else is gonna work. And for you guys out there who call yourselves progressives and are not doing enough, you know what? Get up and fight for what you think is right. That's all I have to say.
Thanks, Alan. I'm gonna get the last caller. Was that Alan Inglewood? Get your last comment in fast. We want to hear from you.
All right. Well. I'm glad I have the last call because maybe I can put some on everybody's mind, especially African Americans. We've been fighting a struggle for a long time, and not to say it was a wrong struggle, but I really think that African Americans in this country and our leadership and those of us who take the mantle to be leadership should start really thinking, well, maybe we should think about trying to establish something somewhere else as our own government. We have more people than most third world countries, as a people in America. Maybe we should start thinking about, hey, maybe we can go somewhere else and struggle hard, like we struggle here, to establish our own land base, our own government, our own educational system, our own medical system. We can do it. We just have to, I think we're still stuck in that old slave mentality, is that we think that the man is still going to take care of us, and we can really involve ourselves in his system that he will not give up power for unless it's this real struggle.
Thanks so much. We're glad we got your last comment in. Well, folks, 213-387-2800. Please call to talk about books, people, money, folks. That ends our program today of Voices from the Frontlines. This is your host, Eric Mann. I want to thank you for joining us and hope you join us next Monday at 4. We'd like to thank our guests, Damon Ozzoli and Patrice Cullors, and join us again on the 28th of September. Today we heard music from Dead Prez, Mos Def, John Lee Hooker, and LL Cool J. You can listen to previous Voices show at www.thestrategycenter.org and send comments to voices@thestrategycenter.org. We'd like to thank our producer, Alan Minsky, our production assistant, Lisa Adler, our engineer, Maggie Lapique, and we'll see you next week for Voices from the Frontlines Radio. Up next is Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. Nice job today, Maggie. I heard your show.